You recall how those comic strips always began with a serious quote at the top? Serious quote, and then, of course, the cartoon followed. And I don't recall many of those quotes, but one somehow stuck with me, and that was, time goes, you say, ah, no, we go, time stays. And I'm not sure what that, how much truth there is in that, but anyway, it's an interesting point of view. Someone else has said that time is Mother Nature's way of assuring that not all things happen simultaneously. A way of spreading things out. And some time ago I read a little story of a Russian poet who arrived in New York City and realized he'd left his watch in his luggage and didn't have it at hand. So he walked up to a local citizen and asked him in somewhat broken English, "What is time?" And the New Yorker said, "Oh, well, you'll have to go to a philosopher for that to find out the answer to that question." Anyway, time is an awfully, is a very, very, is an idea we use regularly, every day, and in a way we live in time like the fish lives in the water, I suppose. We can't quite conceive what it is because it's so much a part of our own existence. We sense of the passage of time, and we realize it's in some sense a human invention. We can't conceive of our own existence without it, and yet stating what it is not a simple matter. Last year there was a speaker series in Portland, and in preparation for this, the organization that was bringing the speakers to the city prepared a brochure. And one of the speakers had as a topic something to do with time. And there was in that the little blurb that described his talk a quotation taken from one of his writings. And he said there, "Whenever we attempt to bridge or find a connection between the physical and the spiritual side of life, we find ourselves confronted with the meaning and significance of time." We know that time is very much of importance to people who work in the physical, with physical things, that is, the physicist or people who work in mechanics or what have you. But it's also important to people who have a spiritual sense and who think about spiritual matters. Might illustrate that with just an analogy. Take music, for example. There are physical and emotional or spiritual components in music. Clearly, we like to have the physical components there. Physical component or the measured aspects of time there. The metronome is a common device for a music teacher. And when an orchestra tunes up, the first violinist plays a concert pitch A, which is 440 cycles per second, as I recall. And when we hear a Brandenburg Concerto by Bach, we like to hear that strict rhythm in there. If it's not there, we know something is missing. On the other hand, there is a kind of spiritual or emotional side to music. We speak of music coming from the heart. It's not something that is hammered out by computers. We don't like that idea too much. You know, computers can put together music, but we don't really like the idea very well because we think that music springs from the inner self, from the emotions, and is far more than any computer can generate. Without the physical, mechanical side, music becomes chaotic and amorphous and has no form. But without the spiritual feeling side, music, we say, is wooden. So the sense of time, the timing, is much at the heart of the search for balance between the physical and the spiritual side in music. Very slight delay in an attack or a certain pause in the piece of music can add a kind of poignancy or a very definite feeling to the music that wasn't there before. And the musician has to be sensitive to this very critical element of time in music. Now, I'd like to just spend a little time with looking at the way in which ancient peoples perceived time and how we look at time today. The ancients, I think, perceived time in a very different way than we do, for the most part. And we sense that, well, my references will be mainly from the Old and New Testaments, but it's also true of other peoples of the time of the Old Testament. The Babylonians, the Egyptians all had similar perceptions of time. And the important thing here, I think, is that the content, rather than chronology and extent, were the most important aspects of time. They weren't so concerned about the ordering of events as we are. They didn't think a lot about the extent of time, but different times had different content for them. And you catch that in Ecclesiastes, where the writer speaks about a time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to pluck up what is planted, a time to kill, a time to heal, a time to break down, a time to build up, a time to weep, a time to laugh, a time to mourn, a time to dance. These are not calendar dates, but they're times when you feel a certain confluence of events or streams of time, and they come together to give significance to what's happening. It's also you find it in Shakespeare. There was a tide in the affairs of men which, when taken at its full, leads on to, I forget the quotation exactly, but anyhow, the same kind of feeling. You have a kind of confluence of experiences or flows of time that come to a critical moment, and that is the important thing. You see it also in the New Testament. Jesus speaks about various times. Each of them is in God's hand. In Matthew 16:3, you can read the signs of the weather, but you cannot discern the signs of the times. In Luke 19:44, Jesus wept over Jerusalem, for she did not know that the time of your visitation. And in 1 Peter 4:7, the end of all things is at hand. Here a sense of time again, but not this mechanical chronological time that we so often think of. One phrase that pops up in the New Testament quite often is the present age. What do we mean by the present age? This to the New Testament time, all the New Testament peoples also certainly had temporal aspects, I presume, but basically was a qualitative thing. It had to do with the quality of the time. Another phrase, this world, the world to come, when you read that in the New Testament, you might think, this world is the one we're in right now, and the world to come is some kind of world that's off in the future, and we're moving toward it. But most modern-day theologians, I think, would say that when in the New Testament there is mention of the world to come, it is not necessarily a time that follows this time. Some years ago, I read a statement by the Swedish theologian Bishop Aulén, and much of what I read doesn't stick with me. But somehow this stayed in my mind. He said that the kingdom of God is, the kingdom of God is equally remote and equally near to every age. Equally remote and equally near to every age. So that no matter where you are, when you live, the kingdom of God is potentially a present thing for you. It's not something that we strive toward, and through progressive approximations or refinements, finally reach the kingdom of God, but instead it's a present reality. That's, I think, the dominant view among biblical students today. And at the time that I read that, it was a very helpful thing to me, because I was always a little bit concerned about this notion of the world striving toward a perfect kingdom eventually. It didn't seem to be going that way. But when you can see the kingdom of God as a state that is potentially present for us here and now, it's a helpful thing, I think, in reading the New Testament and understanding what the Christian faith is about. You're all familiar with the word kairos and the word chronos. Chronos is a Greek word that refers to succession of moments or chronological time, and kairos is this word the Greeks used to describe a moment that had a particular fullness or a particular meaning. So it's, the New Testament speaks more in terms of kairos than it does in terms of chronos. Now, insofar as the ancient peoples thought about the extent of time, that is, how long the world existed or when the end of time would come, they really had a rather limited concept. They didn't, their imaginations did not stretch very far into the past, nor did they reach very far into the future. For the Greeks and Hebrews, the beginning was not very long ago. A rather cozy world insofar as extent was concerned. When you read the New Testament, you get the impression from the writers in the early church that the return of Jesus was imminent, would come during their lifetimes, they thought. The end of the world was at hand, and sometimes we can read this as meaning they felt that the span of time ahead of them was really very, very limited. The heavens were finite. The world that was, or the universe that was understood by the New Testament peoples as well as the Greeks was a Neoplatonic world. And you've seen pictures of this, I think, in books that show this sphere, the outer sphere being the place where the spirits dwelt and God dwelt. And as you moved in toward the center, you moved in toward the earth and progressively through less rarefied and less spiritual realms, and finally you came to the earth, and inside the earth was hell. So you moved from the pure spirit world in toward a world that was toward a region that was more earthly, more evil, and then ultimately toward the center, which was hell. And this was the kind of world that was the kind of universe that was in the minds of most people through New Testament times, through the Middle Ages, even up to the Renaissance. People had basically this perception of the universe. So it was a very restricted world. And in 1650, you remember it, Bishop Usher declared that the world came into being in the year 4004 BC, and many people up to the time of the Renaissance believed that because Christ was the center of all things, therefore the end of the world would come about 4004 AD. He stood at the center of time as well as the center of all of our spiritual life. There was this notion at hand. That's a rather cozy world, you know, 8,000 year old universe, began back here 4000 BC and ends in 4000 AD. Now it's another interesting aspect of this, of the perception of time that people in the New Testament and the Middle Ages had, has to do with the subdivision of time. How did they subdivide time? The first evidence of a sundial was about 1500 BC, and there's a passage in the Book of Kings, 2 Kings chapter 20, that suggests that the Old Testament peoples had sundials. Here, see, this is chapter 20, beginning verse 9. Isaiah replied, well, he's speaking now to King Hezekiah. Isaiah replied, "The Lord will give you a sign to prove that he will keep his promise. Now, would you prefer to have the shadow on the stairway? Go forward 10 steps, or go back 10 steps? And Hezekiah answered, "It's easy to have the shadow go forward 10 steps. Have it go back 10 steps. Isaiah prayed to the Lord, and the Lord made the shadow go back 10 steps on the stairway set up by King Ahaz. A reversal of time for 10 steps worth of time reversal in the Old Testament. But it suggests they at least looked at the shadows to keep track of the passage of time. And there is an account of a Roman poet who lamented the fact that the sundial had ever been invented, because he said it fragmented his days and broke them up into little pieces. We say the same thing about our watches, you know. I was thinking this morning about places in the New Testament where there's specific reference to intervals of time, to or particular times of day. Maybe you can think of some. In the crucifixion story, we read that noon darkness fell over the earth, and at the third hour, Jesus cried, "Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani." And then there's the account of the owner of the vineyard who went out to find workers for the vineyard, and he went out early in the morning, it says, I think, and found workers for his vineyard. He went out again at noon, he found some more, went out at 3 in the afternoon, found some more workers, and even as late as 5 o'clock, at the fifth hour, he went out to find some workers. But the references to specific time intervals or times of day are really quite rare, and people just were not caught up and absorbed with this passage of time like we are. But things change very dramatically once the scientific age began, the age of exploration and navigation required that clocks be used to travel, so they could travel across the oceans. The development of commerce and lending of money, the scientific revolution required careful measurements of time, and of course now we can invest money in our, or put money in a savings account and get interest paid continuously. So there you have a continuous subdivision of time into infinitely small subdivisions. Remember how the Greeks would argue about the possible length of time intervals, and Zeno had these many paradoxes about the arrow flying and the hound chasing the rabbit or whatever it was, and the person running around the racetrack, and all of that had to do with how finely you could subdivide time. We divide it, of course, with no thought at all. My family and I lived for 2 years in Germany, and I used to like to ride these elevators that they had then. I think they've taken them out of Germany mainly now, but maybe you're familiar with them. They were like dumb waiters. A continuous belt. You had these platforms that rode around from the bottom of the building to the top, and went over the top, came back down again, and then up again, and they never stopped. You just jumped on and rode to the next floor, and then you hopped out. And I got on one of these, and well, someone told me once if you went over the top, it would squash you and then deposit you at the bottom, but they didn't do that. Anyway, I got on one of these one time, and a fellow came running across the lobby a little bit late, and the elevator had already moved about a foot or so above the floor, and he jumped up and got on the elevator and said to me, "Zeit ist Geld," Time is money. He wanted to save earn a few pennies. I'd be interested to know where that saying came from, or how old it is. Time is money. Probably came out of the days when commerce had its beginning.
Yeah, it sounds like the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Might have also been when the first lawyer started working.
Yeah. Well, anyway, that's another interesting aspect of time, I think. Now, in our modern age, the perception of the scope of time has really broadened immensely. There's a very nice book by Lauren Isley on the Darwin century, and in this he makes the point at some length that it was not until human beings had expanded their imaginations to allow a great expanse of time that evolution was even thinkable. If there had not been the work of many, many scientists and scholars that gradually expanded our sense of the full scope of time, there would have been no possibility for evolution ever to be accepted, because it required so many years to develop. And those of you who looked into the development of evolution, or how it came about, know that there was a lot of work in geology, in astronomy, and in biology that suggested long periods of time. They found rocks high on mountains, and these could not have been placed there with, or could not have appeared there without the time for the upheaval of the earth to raise certain sections of the earth thousands of feet into the air. They found artifacts under many, many layers of silt in the bottom of seas. And clearly this could not have taken place except over a long, long period of time. And one of the most eminent precursors of Darwin was the British geologist Hutton. And he said, "The result of our present inquiry is that we find no vestige of a beginning and no prospect of an end of time." And with his work and other people's work, there came about this extension in human understanding of time that allowed the theory to develop. Modern astronomy has likewise expanded our sense of time greatly. And now we speak of the universe as having come into being about 15 billion years ago, and the Earth 4.5 billion years ago. I read a little statement by a fellow a while back. He said that when he was a child, the world was 2 billion years old, and now it's 4.5 billion, so he figures he's grown 2.5 billion years. So his age is 2.5 billion years plus a few years now. Well, these quantities of time are really unimaginable to us, but nonetheless, I suspect that like the expanse or the growth in the scope of time prior to evolution, these ideas of the extent of time are having an impact upon our religious perceptions as well, and how we think about the world and our own destinies and our own origins are all part of this understanding of what time is like. Well, that's enough talking by me. You may have some observations or some comments about what time means to you, or how you feel it fits into the picture.
Do you think that our understanding, our sense of time, the strong sense of chronology and our sense of timeliness gets in the way of our understanding of of certain things, for example, in the New Testament or the Old Testament. That it's such a different view of things and it's such a different use of what appears to be the same words. It actually inhibits sort of like we're coming from another planet almost.
Yeah. Well, I think it places quite a responsibility on biblical scholars to reconstruct in some way what the time frame for the Old Testament and New Testament peoples was, and thereby help to interpret for us how they perceived their own age. How can you bring the story of the New Testament into present times and make it a meaningful one? And
it's more subtle in a way, I think, than just language translating. Concept translating.
There's other concepts too, though. The concept of the physical universe also has changed, as well as the chronological. Even if you just go back as far as the Elizabethan, where they still had that idea of heaven and the stars and then the planets and then the sun and the earth in the center. That was a physical concept. And I don't know if that's actually relevant to like New Testament times, because that was much further back in a completely different culture, but I'm pretty sure the physical universe concept was different than ours too.
One of the things that struck me that you were saying was that I think our common language, in fact, I think our common religious language, even if it's unsophisticated, still supports that notion that heaven is up there and hell is down there. That's still in common parlance. I mean, that it's as common as the sun coming up. The sun doesn't come up at all. So there's these vestiges left in our everyday language, and I'm afraid in our mentalities too. I bet the Bible is sort of a culprit in that, in maintaining that because of its language.
I think also the role of myth play is important here, and many are still a little bit frightened by the notion of myth, but I think it's a very, very important idea, and I think it's important for every person to realize that we all live by certain myths, and whether they are in fact scientifically true or not is somewhat beside the point. We can still live with them, and they can serve as a guide and direction in our lives. Despite the fact there are many, many inconsistencies between that myth and what in fact is understood by us in our scientific viewpoint of the world. There are many, many stories, many of the parables that Jesus told, they aren't exactly myths, I guess, but in the Old Testament creation myths clearly are not in sync with our own understanding of what the world is like, and very, very few people, would say that there is a consistency there. But they still are useful stories to us in terms of getting our bearings in this very complex world, and somehow being a daily guide to us in our day-to-day actions and responses to our world.
Some of this notion of subdividing time and measuring it to many decimal points of precision ties in with just the whole Western thought, which is more of a reductionistic, where we break things into the component parts and try to understand them as individual pieces, as opposed to a more holistic way of seeing things, which I think it might be a little difficult to do with spiritual things.
Yes,
spiritual concept.
Mm-hmm. well, there's been for some time now a trend in the direction of holistic thinking, I think, at least among certain peoples in the church and in medicine. You find we try to stop looking at things in an atomistic way and pull them together. And
sounds to me that as our culture evolved, as the technology evolved, that it was the demands upon time that changed the concept of time. It's not like people were scurrying around with microscopes and discovering undiscovered time particles and then changing the theories based on that. It sounds like as it became more important to be at work by a particular time or lose your job, watches became important, clocks became important, and I'm thinking that it was our demands on time that were the major causes of how our perception of it changed.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what you were saying.
Yeah, I guess so. The world is certainly organized differently today economically, and that it was in New Testament times.
I'm just curious, Bill, how they did, when they say, like, that this happened at the sixth hour in the Bible, at the Bible study this morning, we're reading in Mark.
Yes, yeah.
And what were they measuring with? What was the measure of the sixth hour and the fifth hour in the Bible?
Well, that was measured from noon, I think.
From what?
The sixth hour, I think, was 6 hours after noon.
Okay, so this was that stare thing coming in, was this?
Oh, yeah, I'm not sure what that involved there. That was, a kind of loosening reference to apparently tracing a shadow along a stair
someplace. Yes, that's what I was wondering, was that the sixth stair, or was this a sundial measure, or what kept track of these hours?
Well, the Egyptians used water clocks. They would fill a tank with water, and depending on what the level was, they could determine how many hours had passed.
Yes.
And, of course, high noon has always been an important demarcation point.
Yes.
And the Chinese set up very extensive observatories to measure the moment at which noon passed. So that I think is probably the Old and New Testament point also at which they began to measure time. Because you can pick that out. You can't determine when midnight happens. That's unless you have a clock that measures precisely 12 hours beyond noon.
Yes.
That sort of thing.
So you don't know what they measured, what the sixth hour was, what their measure was.
I don't know what they used to keep the time. No, I don't.
No.
No.
Okay.
Anybody know about that?
The Romans had sundials.
Yes. Yeah.
At least by 200 BC, they had sundials.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I'm sure since, at least in New Testament times, since they were under Roman occupation, I'm sure they brought or built sundials.
So maybe on the streets of Jerusalem, there might have been a sundial on the wall someplace that the people could have referred to, or do they have sundials in their homes? I've never run across anything like that to indicate how they mark the hours.
Well, they don't have to be very big, so
yeah.
It's conceivable that almost anybody could have one that wanted one. I mean, I've seen today in gardens sundials that are only this big, and that's about the sort of precision they were dealing with. They weren't down to the minute or even the quarter hour, I don't think.
Yeah, more often the references are to things happening either at break of day or at sunset, and very, very relaxed point of view regarding passage of time. Well, I saw in the museum once a sundial that was the size of a pocket watch. You could open up the lid and flip up a little piece and hold it out in the sun and read off the time.
Mm-hmm.
our notion of time has changed in just in the century with relativity. The fact that time itself is not constant. I mean, that for practical purposes and every day, of course, it is, but in physics anyway.
Yes. And no longer do any physicists think of separating time from space.
Right.
They're integral. Belong together.
Even in everyday use, though, it's not constant now. The origins of time were based on the Earth spinning and going around the sun. And I think it was 2-3 weeks ago they added a leap second because the Earth is slowing down.
Yes.
And that's not even a constant.
Well, our time is not up, but unless somebody else has some interesting question to pose or observation, why maybe we can go have lunch.
Could you read that quote from this Swedish, I don't know, is it a philosopher, a theologian, that you did something about the kingdom of heaven?
Yes, yeah.
Being at hand, and it has a capability of being at hand now and also later.
Yeah, he said the kingdom of God was no more remote, no more remote from nor near any given time or generation. So every generation is equally near the kingdom of God and equally remote from the kingdom of God. No difference there. Okay.
Thanks for bringing that telescope last night. The telescope.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Do you know when you'll be doing that again?
Tomorrow night, certainly. I'm not sure about tonight yet. It'll be announced at the evening meal.
How late did you have it out last night?
Oh, I was out until about 11:30, I think.
Oh, it was getting dark then.
Yeah, it was very nice about that time.
I wasn't there, but I was up, and it was the sky about midnight, and I was amazed at how many stars.
Yep, right. It starts to improve about 11 o'clock, and really gets good by midnight. Shortly thereafter.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.